Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today we're going to talk about the thought experiment, the process of constructing an imaginary situation to help shed light on how things really are. It's an indispensable tool in the philosopher's toolbox, and it's even got a long history in science as well. But while some thought experiments help clarify an issue, others are totally worthless and can even be misleading. So I'd like to talk about some examples of thought experiments in science and philosophy and ask, what are they good for? And what distinguishes a valid thought experiment from an invalid one?
Good question. By the way, before we go ahead, I'd like to say that the what you just said about thought experiments, which is that some of them are, you know, interesting and bring up interesting, you know, conclusions or points, and other, on the other hand, are misleading or downright wrong. Mm-hmm. Pretty much that applies to real experiments as well, right?
I mean,
and in fact, it would be kind of interesting to figure out whether it applies to real experiments for similar reasons, or is it because of completely different structure of the two?
I actually think there are some similarities in the way that real experiments and thought experiments can fail, but let's leave that as a bit of a teaser and get to that in a bit. For starters, maybe we should talk about the more successful thought experiments, because there have been some pretty illuminating thought experiments that have been used. You brought up one of my favorites in the teaser for this episode, which was Galileo's thought experiment showing that objects of different mass will fall at the same rate.
Right. So Galileo was faced, of course, with Aristotelian physics. And according to Aristotle, bodies would fall at a different speed depending on the mass. And we know today that that is false. And the first one to point out that was the case was Galileo. And the interesting thing is that Galileo didn't do it by actually doing any experiment. I know that the mythology is that he actually went on the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped weights of different, bodies of different mass and all that. He never did that.
Right, but this is even cooler.
Right, exactly. This is even better because he figured the whole thing just by thinking about it. And then many, many years later, during the Apollo 15 mission on the moon, the experiment was actually done in front of cameras and broadcast throughout the world. And sure enough, it turns out that Galileo was in fact right. And of course, the reason they did it on the moon is because there is no friction. And so you don't have to deal with the interfering effects of the atmosphere. But essentially, Galileo thought in this way. He said, well, look, there's supposed that there are two bodies. One is heavy, the other one is light. And according to Aristotle, they should fall down at different speeds. Now, what happens if you join them somehow with a cord or something? Now, from an Aristotelian perspective, you could think about the combined body in two different ways. On the one hand, you could say, well, the combined body is now heavier because it's got the heavy body plus the light body, so it should fall faster. On the other hand, by the same Aristotelian logic, it's also true that the light body is going to drag, slowly, the heavy body, so it should be actually slowing it down. If you put the two things together, you get a contradiction.
Right.
And if you get a contradiction, Galileo reasoned, then that can't be true. And as a bonus, he got the real, by reductio ad absurdum, by pushing the argument to the extreme limit, he got the right answer, which is that the two bodies will fall, in fact, at the same rate. Now, the reason this is a particularly successful example of a thought experiment is because it's one of those instances where we really did gain knowledge about the universe, empirical knowledge about the universe, by just thinking about it. Because if you think about it, Galileo's conclusion is not a matter of logical necessity. You know, if the law of gravitation were different, things would be working differently. And he did not have any data. He just made up the hypothetical situation. It's not that he started out with empirical data. So this is a great example where starting out with no data and using simply intuition and logical reasoning, the guy came up with something entirely new, which we still know today 400 plus years later to be true.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most exciting kinds of thought experiment, where your conclusion is a new and accurate fact about the external world. But there are other kinds of totally valid thought experiments that have a different purpose, I would say, especially the kind used in philosophy. And there, I think the purpose is more along the lines of helping us clarify what we actually believe. So, for example, pointing to inconsistencies in multiple things that we think we believe simultaneously. So, for example, if I think that I believe that there's a moral obligation to save someone's life if it would be at small cost to myself, and I also believe that I'm not doing a moral wrong by not giving away a lot of my income to charity, then a thought experiment such as the sort promoted by Peter Singer could highlight that inconsistency and encourage me to resolve it in one direction or another.
That's right. So thought experiments like the trolley dilemma in philosophy, in ethical philosophy, are interesting not because they want to, their point is not to prove a particular position, but it's to explore how, what are the assumptions that are embedded into our reasoning. Now, the trolley dilemma, as most of our listeners probably know about, is this situation where a trolley is going down the tracks and it's out of control, and you have a chance to save five people that are about to be hit by the trolley if you pull a lever. But if you pull the lever, you're going to hit another innocent person on a different track. Now, when posed in front of that kind of situation, most people would say that, yes, they would pull the lever. Mm-hmm. But when you present them with a different situation, that it's only formally different, at least from an ethical perspective, which is instead of pulling the lever, they would actually have to push somebody in front of the tracks to block the trolley, most people say they wouldn't do it. Now, the two situations are, from an ethical perspective, identical, because in both cases, you're saving five people and you're killing one. But the different reaction most people have highlights the fact that there is an important emotional component to our ethical reasoning, because the only difference there is that instead of doing this rather impersonal thing or pulling a lever, you're actually doing the very personal thing or pushing somebody.
Right. And I actually wanted to talk about this thought experiment because I think it highlights a potential danger with thought experiments. And that's that they can tempt you to specify conditions in your experiment that would never actually occur in the real world. And so it's not clear to me that you can trust the conclusions that the experiment with its imaginary hypothetical conditions leads you to. So, for example, the thought experiment specifies that when you push this man, they always say it's a fat man because a lot of people try to say, well, why don't I just jump on the tracks to save the kids? And so the questioner says, oh, no, you wouldn't have enough mass, so you have to push this fat man. That's the only way to save the kids. And if you push this guy, then that will definitely kill him and it will definitely save the kids. But the problem is, in real life, you could never be sure of that. You could be confident that pushing the man would kill him and would stop the train. But you can't be 100% certain. And so I think there's a reasonable case to be made that sliver of doubt about what could actually happen is enough to justify staying out of it. You could push the man and the train could kill him and still go on to kill the kids. And so there's some wiggle room there. And I think this is also the problem with a much more common and weighty thought experiment cited in politics, which is the ticking time bomb scenario, right, which people bring up when they're arguing that torture is sometimes justifiable. And they say, well, if you knew that torturing this one captive was the only way to find out the location of a bomb that was going to go off soon and kill thousands of innocent civilians, then is torture still wrong? And phrased like that, it is a tricky question, but right. I think one of the best arguments against that thought experiment is that in real life, you never know that torturing the man will definitely save those people's lives. And so, again, maybe that bit of doubt is enough to justify refraining from torture.
I think that's a very good point, but I'm going to slightly disagree with your take on this. And I'm going to try to make a distinction. I think that the point of those thought experiments, such as the trolley dilemma, is in fact to explore people's intuitions or people's reasoning or people's assumptions about, say, moral reasoning. It's not to actually predict what people would do in practice. Just like, the thought experiment Galileo did, the point of that one wasn't to predict what would actually happen if you did drop two different bodies of different mass from the Tower of Pisa. In fact, had he actually done that experiment, he probably would have failed because of the interference of air, which would cause friction on the bodies. So in other words, those kind of thought experiments in which you're referring to these, you know, simplifying assumptions and very strict conditions, that's no different from a thought experiment in physics. And in fact, a lot of, you know, physics, even at sort of a basic introductory level, we study physics and we talk about frictionless surfaces or things that are an ideal gas, things like that. Well, ideal gases don't exist and frictionless surfaces don't exist either. But the reason those experiments work is not because they predict the behavior of actual surfaces or bodies or gases, is because they lead you to think about how under controlled conditions those things would actually work. So I think that the situation is analogous in the case of thought experiments. Now, let me get to your example of the ticking bomb scenario, because I think that one draws out a distinction that is important there. If the question were really purely a matter of what our moral intuitions are, as opposed to being a question of actual policy, I think that question is a valid question. You know, what do you think? If you were faced with that sort of situation, what would you do? The trick is that, of course, as soon as you answer that question, say, well, okay, maybe under those very special conditions, I think that it would be justifiable to do whatever it's possible to save, you know, a million people or something like that. As soon as you admit that in response to a thought experiment for an ideal situation, the person that typically prompts you with that kind of question draws the conclusion that therefore it is acceptable policy to engage in torture under actual real situations. But that wasn't the situation that is covered by the thought experiment. There's a very important distinction between, you know, trying to probe somebody's and push to the limit somebody's moral intuitions, and it's a completely different thing to use those moral intuitions to say, well, therefore, in an actual policy matter under real conditions, here's what I'm going to do. That's I think a very different situation. It would be very much like a scientist who works on the theory of ideal gases to try to use that theory to predict non-equilibrium thermodynamics. It wouldn't work.
Sure, and that's a very good practical reason to avoid actually using these thought experiments in policy decisions.
Yes.
I just meant that if the conclusion that someone's gut reaction is irrational or contradictory in those cases may not be justified, because their gut reaction may be based on the fact that in real life it would be better to refrain, just because you can't have absolute certainty. That's all I meant. We should also probably talk about two of the other big problems that can arise in thought experiments, which is, I would say, first, the problem that they can fool us into thinking that just because we can conceive of something, then it must be possible. And second, that just because we can't conceive of something, then it must not be possible.
Right.
And you gave a good example of the latter either in the teaser or in an article that you wrote for Philosophy Magazine, but about the, I think it was Lucretius who
right.
argued that the universe must be infinite because if you threw a spear at the boundary of the universe, and it went through, well, then it couldn't be the end of the universe. And if it bounced off, then there must be something on the other side of the...
Because there's a boundary between
right.
you and something else. That's right. That's actually apparently the earliest recorded thought experiment.
it's a sporting effort.
Right. And it's a great... it's a great example, because you're right. It does reach a conclusion that turns out to be wrong, because today we think modern physics thinks that the universe can both be bounded and infinite. You know, just think of a toroid, for instance, or even in two dimensions, just a circle. Obviously, that's a surface, that's a figure that doesn't have an end, and yet it is in fact, you know, confined to a particular. It's bounded. So Lucretius was definitely wrong, but it's an interesting experiment, both in terms of sort of historical importance, and also because it started out a tradition of other thought experiments that eventually went wrong, including in physics. I mean, Newton, for instance, proposed a famous experiment involving buckets and rotating spheres and things like that to show that space is absolute. Well, it turns out he was wrong, and, you know, and he was Newton. He wasn't exactly somebody who didn't know anything about physics. Einstein, on the other hand, proposed this famous thought experiment about what would happen if we were to travel, you know, try to catch up with a light wave.
Mm-hmm.
And that showed that, in fact, that was essentially the beginning, the foundations of the basic idea of relativity, showing that, in fact, in the frame of reference in which the observer would find itself would be in accordance to a relativistic view of the universe and not to a Newtonian view of the universe. So, again, we're bringing examples where thought experiments worked and examples where they didn't work. But so far, I think it seems to me fair to say that that's true also for actual experiments. And you know, a thought experiment, it is an interesting question to ask what kind of thing a thought experiment is. And there are several theories in philosophy of science about thought experiments and where they come from. Two that are kind of opposite extremes and are worth considering because they sort of encompass the whole spectrum are due to James Robert Brown on the one hand and to John Norton on the other hand. So according to James Robert Brown, a thought experiment is essentially a way in which we perceive a Platonic reality. And by Platonic reality, it means that the laws of the universe, as well as mathematical constructs such as numbers, are really out there independently of the human mind. Meaning that when we think about mathematics and fundamental physics, we actually discover things, we don't invent them. Now, we could do a whole separate show about Platonism, especially Platonism in mathematics, because it's a really interesting situation. But it sounds like a bizarre notion until you start thinking about the experiment that we started with. Galileo's figuring out something about the real world without new data and without actual experiment. That's an interesting example because where was he getting those ideas from? If in some sense the answer wasn't already out there, it certainly didn't make it up. It's not a construct of Galileo's mind. It's something he discovered. It was out there. It's an actual structure characteristic of the physical world. So how did he discover it? By not having any empirical
means. Well, he realized it. I mean, we frequently have a lot of information rattling around in our minds, and frequently there are logical dependencies between different statements, but we don't realize it until we think hard about it. I don't see how that's as mystical as some philosophers seem to think it is.
No, I don't think this has anything to do with mysticism, but your objection...
surprising or weird.
Right. But your objection goes, in fact, in favor of the other view, the one by John Norton. John Norton thinks of experiments as a kind of if-then reasoning. So he thinks of thought experiments as something that starts out with certain implicit or explicit empirical premises, which we get from previous observation or experience, and then we construct a set of if-then situations where we explore by deductive reasoning what follows from those premises. I assume that that's a more palatable view of what thought experiments are. And if you think about it, it is very similar, at least in my opinion, to the way in which a very different kind of activity works in science. And I'm referring to computer simulations. Mm-hmm. Right. So a computer simulation is something that in a qualitative fashion really works a lot like a thought experiment of the if-then type that Norton is talking about. Because in a computer simulation, you start out with certain premises that you use to build the program or whatever it is you're simulating. Those premises typically come from knowledge that is external to the simulation itself. It's not generated by the simulation. So those are premises that may come out of, you know, knowledge of the laws of physics or certain assumptions about economics or some empirical data or whatever. And then what you do is you write a computer program that is essentially a set of if-then statements and feedback loops that, by deductive reasoning, quantitative deductive reasoning, draws out the consequences of those assumptions, right? A computer simulation doesn't produce new data. I mean, it's true that we often call the output of a computer simulation data, but they're data in a very different sense than the empirical information that we get about from real experiments about the real world, right? These are data that are actually generated by the simulation, and they are a logical and, in fact, necessary consequence of the premises of that simulation. So the idea is the same in thought experiments, according to Norton, that what we do is very much like a qualitative simulation in our mind. We start out with certain premises, and then we build a certain kind of deductive reasoning. And, of course, just like in a computer simulation, there are fundamentally two things that can go wrong with a thought experiment. Either the premises can be wrong, so the reasoning can be perfectly fine, but you start out with wrong premises. And of course, as anybody that has taken Logic 101 knows, if you use deductive reasoning starting out with wrong premises, the conclusion does not in fact follow. Or vice versa, you can start with the correct premises or a set of correct premises, and then you can make a mistake in the actual reasoning. which would be the equivalent of making a mistake in the programming of the simulation, in which case, of course, also you cannot trust the output. But in this case, you cannot trust the output for a very different reason. So if you want to take issue with the results of a thought experiment, you would go about the same way in which you go about if you want to take issues with the results of a computer simulation. You either question the premises or you question the actual program.
I like it. It's not quite as charming as chucking a spear at the edge of the universe, but it sounds a lot more precise. I wanted to make sure to bring up a comment from a reader of our blog that I thought was particularly perceptive. It has to do with the one of the earlier ways that I mentioned thought experiments can go awry, in which they fool us into thinking that just because we can conceive of something, that it must therefore be possible. So commenter JP says, "It seems to me that most of the time when we believe we can conceive of something, we're simply fooling ourselves. We have an image of an object or a scene in which we can use the term in a seemingly meaningful manner, but in fact we have no precise idea at all of what we're talking about. So assuming we can conceive of something doesn't seem to amount to much." And I think I totally agree with this. And I think a great and a common example that we've brought up in previous episodes is the philosophical zombie, the idea that we can imagine a creature who's an automaton whose brain processes, or whose robot brain processes information from the world exactly the way ours does, and who walks, acts and behaves the way we do, but is not at all conscious. And as I believe you and plenty of other smart people have pointed out, this might just be fundamentally inconsistent. So even though we think we can imagine it, it might not actually make any sense. And in fact, I think we may not be conceiving of things when we think we're conceiving of them. Like, I actually think our brains can fool us into thinking that we're imagining something. So like, I could, even something as stark as a square circle, I feel like a lot of people could say, oh, I can sort of imagine that. But maybe what they're imagining is just a circle with like the word square floating around in their mind, you know? And that's not actually imagining it, because it's logically impossible.
Right. Now, as you pointed out, I don't have a particular high opinion of the zombie thought experiment in philosophy of mind, which is due to David Chalmers. On the other hand, there are, in fact, some interesting thought experiments, even in science, that are about conceivability. Mm-hmm. So whenever fundamental physicists, for instance, talk about what the universe would look like if the physical constants were slightly different from what they are, which is a typical way of reasoning about the foundational physics, well, that's perfectly legitimate. So the question that arises in this case is one that has been discussed recently in philosophy of science, which is the relationship between conceivability and possibility. You know, they're not exactly the same thing. Clearly, we can conceive of things that are actually not possible. Mm-hmm. But of course, we can conceive of things that are possible, and we shouldn't limit ourselves to not doing that. But we need to be careful about what we draw as a conclusion out of these experiments, thought experiments. Let me give you an example from philosophy, which I thought it was very amusing. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly one of these situations where the conclusion of the experiment hinges on conceivability. And here's two major philosophers who have very different ideas about what's conceivable. So Frank Jackson famously proposed this experiment, these thought experiments, to show, in his opinion, that there must be something wrong with physicalism. Physicalism is the idea that that mind and consciousness and reduce only to physical characteristics, mm-hmm. right? And so he said, okay, imagine that there's this woman named Mary who grew up in an environment, an experimental environment that is on purpose. It's kept black and white, or, you know, shades of gray. There's no colors anywhere to be seen. Mm-hmm. So she has never had an experience of color throughout growing up. She has been told about color by the scientists who are running the experiments. And it's obvious that the scientists in this case would be engaging in something, in a very unethical behavior. But nevertheless,
it's a thought experiment. We can do anything we want. That's no right. Human subject committee is to bother us.
You cannot go to jail for a thought experiment, right. I suppose. But the idea that Jackson put forth was that, well, look, then suppose that somebody then at some point opens the door and Mary steps out of the confines of the experiment and for the first time experiences color, she would have no idea of what to expect. In other words, the actual experience would be very different from whatever she possibly has learned about color. Which shows that there must be something more than just the physical descriptions and physical understandings of color. Okay, I don't buy that even at that point. But let's assume that you buy that there is something funny in fact about this situation. Hmm. Well, Daniel Dennett, another philosopher of mine, responded in this way. He said that this thought experiment, in fact, he proposed a counter thought experiment that starts out just like Jackson's. But then when Mary leaves the lab, she says, color perception is just as I thought it would be. In other words, the physical description given to her by scientists prepared her exactly for the actual sensorial experience. And what you get out of this experiment is based on your assumptions. Do you think that a physical description of a particular kind of experience is the same as or is as good as the actual experience or not? Depending on how you conceive of the relationship between physical experience and knowledge about the physical experience, you draw completely different results from the experiment.
Yeah, you've made this point before, and I thought it was very well taken. And I think the original thought experiment illustrates another big danger of thought experiments, which is just that if you tell a convincing and believable enough story, then you can. It's very easy to accept the conclusion without questioning the logic of the thought experiment itself.
Right. Unless you're somebody smart like Dennett who actually comes up with a counter thought experiment.
Sure. Right?
That's the whole point, right, of these things. You put them out there so that people can actually look at the assumptions and the reasoning and point out where the flaw is.
Sure. And there's so many that thought experiments that we're not getting a chance to bring up, but I understand that you have a few more waiting for us in the picks. So let's hurry up and move on to the Rationally Speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start with Julia's picks.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is a book called 50 Great Myths of Popular Psychology. I've been enjoying this book a lot because I think, like many people, I'm very vulnerable to urban legends and spurious anecdotes from the world of popular psychology, just because they make such good sound bites that I often don't put in the hard work of actually like checking them the way I should, because they sound so good and they make for such good retelling. But some of the myths in this book I was well aware were myths, but others I actually believed to be true, or at the very least had heard and had not rejected out of hand when I'd heard them. So, for example, I thought it was quite plausible that, just as I'd always heard, expressing your anger or aggression will help dissipate it and that you'll then become less angry. But apparently this is really not the case. For more than 40 years, apparently, studies have been showing that encouraging the expression of anger actually increases your aggression. So one study [S2] Right. [S1] Showing this had people pound nails and do various other activities to express their aggression after someone had insulted them, and then found that the people who had done that were actually more angry later on when measured in a follow-up. So that's one of the other fun things about this book, is just reading about all the clever experiments that that researchers devised to test these popularly believed myths. And it's also striking to realize how many of these statistics and studies that I'd heard about that keep sort of rattling around the popular psyche are actually completely false or fabricated. Like, for example, the study, which you probably have heard about, I've heard about it a million times, in which showing the power of subliminal advertising.
Yes.
So this guy in a series of movie theaters in, I think, New Jersey had subliminal messages flashing ads for Coca-Cola and for popcorn in movie theaters. And the result was that sales of Coke and popcorn skyrocketed during the 6 weeks that this experiment was going on. Turns out the guy made it all up. But it's just like become permanently embedded in our collective psyche.
The story is too good to be true.
Yes, exactly.
So you think that to some extent the problem here is that a lot of pop psychology and self-help books and all that sort of stuff, they're not actually based on psychological research, which is out there, because a lot of people actually look into these things. They're just based on intuitions, right? Somebody's just started down and saying, well, it makes sense to me that we should, deal with this way with anger. And so it starts out writing books about how to deal with anger without actually bothering to check in the literature. I mean, one of the things that struck me some time ago as really interesting is that there is actually research looking into different kind of talk therapy and how effective they are on the long term to change people's behavior. And it turns out that the only one that we know empirically is effective is cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing to me was that then therapists were told this, and for the large part, they completely ignore it, responding that, well, but I know that it works because I see it working on my on my clients, thereby entirely missing the point of a controlled experiment in science. And this actually does harm to people. At least you're wasting your money if you keep going to a therapist who refuses to take into consideration empirical evidence.
Right. And for example, one of the myths that has persisted is that people who are sexually abused as children are all or almost to a one suffer from severe psychological problems as adults. And certainly some of them do. But the statistics are much weaker than you would actually have thought. And so just as you said, when psychologists and therapists were told this, they insisted that it didn't match what they saw in their practice. But of course, the only people they see in their practices are the ones who have psychological problems. So,
it's a non-random sample.
Right, exactly. What's your pick, Massimo?
So my pick is John Norton's website, and in particular, a subset of it called Goodies. John Norton is a philosopher at the University of Pittsburgh, and we'll have the link for our listeners to on our website. Mm-hmm. And the University of Pittsburgh, incidentally, hosts a really interesting and well put together Center for Philosophy of Science. Anyway, John Norton is the same John Norton that I mentioned earlier. He's the one that has the theory that thought experiments are equivalent to if-then kind of sort of deductive reasoning.
Oh, the one I liked.
Yes, the one that you liked. And so Norton's website has a really interesting set of thought experiments that are listed, and some of them are actually shown in animated fashion, and then they're discussed in depth. And the first one, just to give you an example, that comes out on the list is the chasing the light experiment. That's Einstein's famous thought experiment, which Einstein himself, in his autobiographical notes, tells us is what got him started on the general theory of relativity and so on and so forth. And if you look at the website, at Norton's website, there is an animation of how the thought experiment is supposed to work. But then what is interesting is that Einstein thought that this thought experiment clearly indicated that the theory of ether, the idea that which was dominant at the time, the idea that space was not empty, but it was filled with this thing, ether.
Luminiferous ether.
Yes.
You have to say the full name for the cool effect.
Luminiferous ether, that fills space. Einstein thought that this experiment clearly shows the theory to be wrong, but Norton's analysis is really interesting because it goes through the three reasons why Einstein thought that his thought experiment would succeed in debunking the ether theory. And then he gives the ether theorist reply to each one of those three objections, which the reply actually is very interesting and convincing. And then Norton goes on and say why Einstein turned out was in fact right, but not for the reason that he thought it was right. So it makes for a really interesting reason. The website, again, is the John Norton Goodies at the University of Pittsburgh.
Wow, this is very cool. There's all these animations and pictures about Einstein and relativity. And apparently, I'm scrolling down the page now, and there's a separate section arguing that time actually exists, which is very comforting to me.
It might come as a shock, but yes, it turns out it does exist.
All right, we're all out of time, so we're going to wrap up this episode. This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.